Good afternoon. May it please the court. As the state agency charged with enforcing New Jersey's wage and hour laws, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development appears today to address two core issues in this matter. First, the Immigration Reform and Control Act does not preclude an award of compensatory damages to an undocumented worker for work that they have already performed. Second, the wage and hour law and the wage payment law do not exempt from their coverage work performed in exchange for non-cash compensation. In other words, a so-called barter arrangement can absolutely constitute employment under these laws. In affirming dismissal, the panel erred in three ways that, if left undisturbed, will have far-reaching consequences for law-abiding employers, workers, and undocumented people in our state. One, the panel said that there could be no employer-employee relationship between the parties under the IRCA. That is wrong and does not comport with Hoffman Plastic or with the overwhelming authority applying Hoffman. Two, the panel upheld the trial court's finding that there was a barter arrangement distinct from an employment relationship between these parties. The two are not mutually exclusive. Such a holding creates a major loophole for evading our state labor laws by making non-cash payment to workers, whether or not they are documented. And three, the panel also affirmed the trial court's misapplication of the New Jersey Rules of Evidence. I'm happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I will turn to application of the IRCA. The IRCA does not preclude compensating an undocumented person for work already performed. The first issue here is that there is no conflict preemption. The wage and hour law and the wage payment law provide for compensatory damages for work already performed. The IRCA does not preclude such damages. We know from Hoffman that the Supreme Court held work not performed for wages that could not have been lawfully earned were barred. Compensating an employee for work that they did perform, on the other hand, does not conflict with and actually advances the IRCA's objectives. As we explained in our brief, there is also no express or field preemption. And yet the panel held that under Hoffman, an employment relationship with an undocumented person could not exist. But if you look at the language of both the IRCA and of the Hoffman decision, that is simply not true. For example, IRCA says that it is unlawful, quote, after hiring an alien to continue to employ the alien, knowing the person is or has become undocumented. The statute also says that a person who enters into a contract to obtain the labor of an alien, knowing the alien is unauthorized, shall be considered to have hired the alien for employment. The wage and hour law and wage payment law also do not exclude from coverage work that is performed for non-cash payment. This is evident for two key reasons. One is that our wage and hour law defines wages to include the fair value of food and lodging. And in fact, an entire subsection of the wage and hour law regulation tells employers how to calculate the fair value of those types of items. And the second is that the definition of an employee under the wage and hour law and wage payment law has nothing to do with the type of compensation received, but with whether a person is suffered or permitted to work. This court and others have held that this standard is satisfied by an employer's knowledge of or acquiescence to the work being performed. This is precisely what happened here. Defendants do not dispute that they initially hired this plaintiff as an employee and paid him a salary in addition to lodging in exchange for his work. They then modified the agreement to no longer pay the salary, but to provide him with the apartment and utilities in exchange for the same services. Plaintiff's purported acceptance of this so-called barter arrangement is irrelevant. The United States Supreme Court has said that parties cannot contract around wage and hour laws, and there are, in fact, provisions in both the wage and hour law and the wage payment law that void contracts that suggest to do so. And finally, the trial court let in extrinsic evidence of plaintiff's use of a false social security number. Now, before I explain the relevant holding and why it was wrong, I want to underscore that the department here is primarily concerned about the preemption and barter issues. That said, if trial courts admit this type of evidence to discredit undocumented plaintiffs, based on loose admissibility rulings and without applying the pertinent evidentiary rules. Enforcement of wage and hour cases involving undocumented immigrant plaintiffs will be severely impaired. In wage cases without records, the evidence often consists of dueling testimony. And under Mount Clemens, the burden starts out with an employee establishing a prima facie case. Improper or potentially improper admission of extrinsic evidence to impeach a plaintiff's credibility impairs the ability of any plaintiff to carry that burden. The trial court incorrectly held that plaintiff's use of a false social security number was admissible extrinsic evidence relevant to his credibility under Rule 607. The trial court did not acknowledge that 607 explicitly incorporates 608, and 608 prohibits consideration of specific instances of a witness's conduct to support or attack their character for truthfulness. The same is also true for Rule 405. Failure to follow these rules is especially problematic in wage cases involving undocumented immigrants, given the prevalence of the use of false social security numbers to obtain employment. I would also note that the trial court did not consider Rule 403, under which evidence may be excluded if its probative value is substantially outweighed by risk of undue prejudice or confusion of issues. So, to the extent that the social security number evidence was admitted not only for the purpose of challenging the plaintiff's credibility, but also because, as was discussed earlier, it was part of the narrative facts of what transpired here, the judge still should have applied 403. Now, we fully acknowledge that 403 may have less purchase in a bench trial, but we still think it's warranted and it should be dealt with. And regardless, the judge did not apply 607 or 608.
And so under normal circumstances, does the existence of the employer-employee relationship and the setup, meaning the application, the I-9, the W-4, are all those pieces normally part of the discussion when establishing one of these cases?
If Your Honor's referring to deciding whether or not somebody is an employee for purposes of these laws, not necessarily, because the relevant inquiry, again, is whether somebody has suffered or permitted to work. And in this particular case, it's also worth underscoring that there is no dispute, again, that this individual was hired as an employee. They just contend that they then changed the relationship to a barter arrangement simply by changing the form of compensation, which is absolutely not relevant to whether or not he would be an employee.
Would it suffice if the court issued guidance about how to use this information rather than to prohibit it with a blanket prohibition?
Our position, Your Honor, is that it is not blanketly prohibited. Certainly for the purpose of attacking character for truthfulness, 608 says that we cannot look at specific instances of dishonesty. So it should absolutely be out, it appears, under 608. Again, to the extent it is or isn't potentially relevant to other aspects of the case is a question under 401 relevancy and 403, assuming that a plaintiff raises a 403 objection.
Well, what tests should the court be looking at to determine whether someone is an employee? Is it the sufferer permit language? Is it sort of an ABC test that talks about employee vis-a-vis contractor?
Yes. The suffer or permit language is the initial test. It is the very permissive language. It appears, again, in both the definitions of employment in both of these statutes, and it is decidedly broad. The ABC test comes up when a company says, this person was not actually my employee, and they invoke an exception to employment under both the wage payment law and the wage and hour law, which is independent contractor status. In that case, if the plaintiff shows that they received remuneration for services, they are presumptively an employee unless the employer can satisfy all three prongs of the ABC test. So, and what is a critical distinction here, I would say, is that suffered or permitted to work does not ask whether or not somebody is compensated. In other words, somebody could work and not be compensated at all, but they could still be an employee.
In the absence of a claim here that the plaintiff was an independent contractor, is the ABC test relevant to this case?
I think, Your Honor, it would be relevant to the extent that defendants said this was not actually our employee. He was instead our independent contractor.
Right. I'm saying that if there's no such claim, which I don't believe there is in this case, is the ABC test part of the inquiry?
No.
And you've already confirmed something that I wanted to clarify. This is a WHL, WPL proceedings or bench trials?
Your Honor, I can't represent that is always the case necessarily.
But I thought you would reference bench trial earlier in your remarks.
Excuse me, I meant because this particular case was a bench trial, but I don't believe that all wage and hour law or wage payment law cases are necessarily bench trials. Because this case was a bench trial.
Why was this case a bench trial? And where would we look to get the answer to the question?
One place we might look is whether or not the plaintiff requested a jury trial. Beyond that, I don't know the answer.
Are you familiar with jury trials in these proceedings generally?
Perhaps, but I don't want to overstate depending on what your question might be.
There's nothing behind the question except will a jury hear this evidence or are these matters handled by judges?
I can represent, Your Honor, that the Department of Labor certainly has brought Superior Court cases seeking damages under our wage and hour and wage payment law and has requested jury trials. They have not yet been tried. They have not reached that stage of the adjudication.
Is it possible, does the statute say anything about a right to a jury trial or a bench trial? Either the wage payment law or the wage and hour law?
I'm truly not aware right now if it does or doesn't. I can represent, and this is something else that came up in the case, so it was perhaps worth noting, that individuals claiming unpaid wages have an option to either go to Superior Court to pursue those claims. They also have an option of going through an administrative process with the Department of Labor. And that is part of the record that this plaintiff did file a wage claim with the Department of Labor. However, the import and result of that wage claim is misconstrued.
I understand you'd like a little more time to, before giving us a definitive answer, if the court were to ask for a supplemental submission on this.
Absolutely. Just to clarify, Your Honor, on the question of whether or not litigants are entitled to a jury trial under the wage and hour law and wage payment law.
We'll give guidance if we go that route.
If a jury trial is an option, would your analysis as to the admissibility of the immigration status change at all?
Your Honor, I don't think it changes much. It certainly doesn't change under the credibility determination. Whether or not it changes under a 403 analysis, I think it's the risk of prejudice is likely higher if that is before a jury.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add at this time, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to make this one note about the wage claim that plaintiff filed. The department did not determine or conclude that no wages were owed. The department does not tend to pursue an investigation dealing with a one-on-one dispute between an employee and an employer. And so instead, once the department learned from defendants that they did not have wage records, the department did issue some penalties for both the wage and hour violations, record keeping violations under the wage and hour law. There was also a penalty under the wage payment law. And when defendants paid those penalties at a negotiated lesser amount than was originally assessed, the department explicitly informed defendants, quote, this settlement does not waive the employee's right to request a wage hearing for the balance of their claim if they so desire. In other words, referencing the administrative wage collection section in the Department of Labor. And instead, this plaintiff, as was his right, elected to pursue his claims in Superior Court. I don't think from this record we can know exactly why, but one reason might be that there is a monetary cap on how much an employee can recover through a wage collection proceeding. And I would just conclude by asking—
Yes, one other thing related to that. Are you aware of monetary penalties that IRCA has?
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
I can, Your Honor. I do have that. One minute. So under 8 USC 1324A, I believe, there are civil penalties for employing an undocumented person. On first violation, there is a range of $250 to $2,000. A second violation.
Can you say this one more time?
Oh, sure. I believe it is 8 USC 1324A. And the violations increase for a second violation and for subsequent violations.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Just want to conclude, Your Honor, by asking that this case be remanded and that this court clarify a couple important things. One being that the IRCA does not preclude an award of compensatory damages to an undocumented person for work that they have already performed. The second is that bartering does not take work out of the scope of our wage and hour laws. And the court, we would ask, should also direct proper application of the rules of evidence, including application of 608, 405, and 403 as appropriate. Thank you.
Mr. Deere.
May it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, you asked about the jury trial issue. I can tell you and represent in this particular case, the plaintiff in the complaint requested a jury trial, but at some point in time during the case, the jury trial was waived. And that's why this case was tried before a judge.
Is there a right to a jury trial to your knowledge?
I believe there is. I believe there is under the wage and hour law. But in this particular case, that for whatever reason or another, it was waived. This case is fairly unique in terms of some facts and some legal issues. I just want to kind of try to touch on a few of them and be kind of brief. I request the court's indulgence on a couple of issues. With request to the W-4 issue and the narrative, I think the Chief Justice brought up, it is part of the narrative because that's how Mr. Lopez got the job. He represented, he had a Social Security number. He represented that when he filled out the W-4 form, that his Social Security number was valid. Now, in a case cited by the Department of Labor in a footnote, and also, it's also in one of the amicus briefs, Kansas versus Garcia, 589 U.S. 191, is United States Supreme Court case 2020. The court notes that a W-4 form helps someone get a job, but is not used to show authorization to work. That's on page 192. It also notes that on page 197, a fraudulent submission of a W-4 is potentially a federal crime under 26 U.S.C. 7205. And finally, on page 207, the court says, talking about the IRCA Federal Employment Verification System, quote, the federal government verification system does not include things that an employee must or may do to satisfy requirements unrelated to work authorization, and completing tax withholding documents plays no part in the process of determining whether a person is authorized to work. Instead, those documents are part of the apparatus used to enforce federal and state income tax laws. Now here, Mr. Lopez signs the W-4 and gives it to Mr. Ruan. Mr. Ruan takes it to his payroll service, submits it, and they pay Mr. Lopez, I believe, the first check of 2 weeks. Payroll service comes back and says to Mr. Ruan, Social Security number here is not valid. Mr. Ruan goes to Mr. Lopez, and I think this is important, and says, payroll company says, this is not valid. I can't pay you legally. I can't pay you legally because this number doesn't work. He does offer him a barter with no strings attached. You can stay, you can go. I'm not keeping track of your hours. You can leave tomorrow if you have a better opportunity somewhere else. But he also says to him, and this is in both the appellate division decision on page 4 and the trial court decision on page 21. Mr. Ruan says to Mr. Lopez, look, fix this issue and I will pay you. Now, at that point, if you're Mr. Lopez and you know you are not, you don't have status, that you're undocumented, he can't get a Social Security number, but he can go get an individual taxpayer identification number, regardless of status. Mr. Lopez actually had the power to stop the barter, because if he comes back with the individual tax identification number and says to Mr. Ruan, here is my individual tax identification number, you have to pay me, Mr. Ruan has to pay him. And if he doesn't, this case is totally different. Because Mr. Ruan didn't say to Mr. Lopez, you're undocumented. He said, payroll says this doesn't work. So.
Wouldn't IRCA direct that he terminate that employment?
IRCA directs that he terminates the employee when he knows he's undocumented. At that point, he doesn't know that. All he knows is the social doesn't work. When he hands back the W-4 and says, I can't pay you legally, it's because he can't withhold taxes.
Were you done with your opening statement, or are you accepting questions? No, I was kind
of, but you can, if you have a question, Justice, I'll take it.
It's up to you. If you want to
finish. No, you can go ahead. It's fine.
Whose obligation is it to determine somebody's eligibility to work? Does the employee have an obligation to present evidence that he's eligible, or does the employer have an obligation to verify somebody's ability to work?
I think it's both. I think the employee has an obligation to present evidence vis-a-vis an employment application, W-4 form, or an individual tax ID number that I can work. And I think it is incumbent on the employer, in this case, he verifies it by giving it to his payroll service.
But didn't the employer have an obligation to file an I-9 form, or to at least retain an I-9 form to make sure that the employee was eligible to work?
Under IRCA, I agree. Yes, that's true. And the record doesn't reflect that Mr. Ruan did that. What he does do is Mr. Lopez presents a form of ID, and he says to him, I have a valid number. I have a valid social. Mr. Ruan relies on those representations.
But it's the number that matters, not the representation, whether the number is valid or not.
I agree.
Okay, and once it's invalid, he technically wasn't allowed to keep him in his employ.
He's not allowed to pay him. He says, I can't pay you.
Sorry, IRCA, though, doesn't say anything about whether you're allowed to pay the person. It just says that, it prohibits the use of a, quote, contract, subcontract, or exchange, so it doesn't have to be written, to, quote, obtain the labor of an alien, close quote. So it doesn't say, you know, it's okay to employ someone who is undocumented, you just can't pay them. It says that it is illegal. This is 8 U.S.C. 1324 A.A. 4. So from where should we understand that it is okay to employ someone who's undocumented, but just not to pay them?
I would say that the way I would answer that is, you're correct, but in this particular case, Mr. Ruan can't pay him because the social's no good.
But as Justice Patterson said, Mr. Rouen then had an obligation to say, I'm so sorry, I cannot allow you to work anymore.
I agree, Your Honor. He did not, under IRCA, he is to discharge him. I agree.
Under IRCA what, I'm sorry?
Under IRCA, when he finds out, if and when he finds out he is undocumented, he is supposed to discharge him. That's what IRCA says.
It's not about being undocumented. It's about the fact that he can't provide a Social Security number to effectuate the withholdings that the W-4 requires, right? It has nothing to do with being undocumented. He just can't provide work authorization.
Under IRCA? No, because I respectfully disagree. Under the Garcia case, the W-4 form is not indicative of authorization.
But if you're saying that a U.S. citizen that provided a Social Security number that was wrong, right, and you submit that to payroll, payroll can't verify the Social Security number, you can't pay them either.
That's right? Correct.
So then the alternative is to discharge them or get a valid Social Security.
Correct.
Nothing to do with the fact that they're undocumented.
Correct.
Okay. So in this case, you didn't have a valid Social Security number. So then the response should have been to discharge.
I agree. And what he says, I agree. And he says, I can't, and the response that Mr. Ron gives him is, I can't pay you. And he says, I can offer you this until you get me something, and then I can pay you.
Was that lawful? Was there? Can you point us to anything that shows that that arrangement would be lawful?
No.
I thought you stated earlier that at the point at which the employer was told that the Social Security number was not a valid Social Security number, he didn't know that he was undocumented. But now you seem to be agreeing, yes, at that point, employer should have under IRCA released him, because in your opening statement, you said it was plaintiff's obligation. At that point, plaintiff had held all the cards and could have done what he needed to do in order to properly be paid. But I think what some of us are arguing is actually it was the employer's obligation to at that point discharge him. You responded, I think, to that question by stating the employer had no idea that he was undocumented at this point. So what is it that you,
my argument,
what is your position?
The record reflects that Mr. Rouen says to Mr. Lopez.
Can you keep your voice up a little bit?
The record reflects that Mr. Rouen says to Mr. Lopez, Social Security number is invalid. I cannot legally pay you. He does not say to him, I'm questioning your status, immigration status. He just says, I can't legally pay you. That's all he says. He says to him, if you address this issue, I will pay you. And at that point, it happens. And he offers him this barter.
But that actually runs counter to what it sounds like the record suggests happened, which is, there is a counter that says, I will pay you $400 plus the apartment and utilities, and that's paid for the first 2 weeks, right? That's post discovering the social is invalid, or is that before?
That's pre. He pays them before. There's checks that are issued before the social comes back that it's no good. He doesn't pay him monetarily after the social is discovered.
And what was the reason the amount jumped down from the original $1,600 plus the rental to for 400. There was an original amount that was higher, right?
I thought it was just 1600 per month, which is 400 per week.
Yeah, so it was 1600 per month, Justice, and then he was taking back. Mr. Lopez would pay him 800 for the apartment if he was paying him monetarily.
In any event, you agree that New Jersey's wage and hour law and wage payment law define employee as any person suffered or permitted to work by an employer, correct?
Yes.
And they provide that for any employee, they must be paid both a minimum wage, and it sets forth exactly what that minimum wage is, and that it has to be paid in 2 week increments, correct?
That's what the law says, yes, yes.
So where is the exception that we should find in the law that says, but you do not have to do this if the person is undocumented? Or where is your argument as to why those two do not apply here?
Because he lied about it.
But where in the wage and hour law or wage payment law does it say, and if the employee lies, you do not have to pay them?
It is not that. What you're asking for is not contained in that law.
So is there a basis under the law that says the wage and hour law and the wage payment law do not apply in this case?
In this case, that goes to the issue of the trial court and the appellate division invoking part of the Hoffman decision.
So looking at the two state laws, on their face they apply.
Correct.
And you are relying on IRCA and its interpretation and Hoffman to say not so.
I'm relying on what the trial court and the appellate division rely upon is.
Right. Go ahead.
The part in Hoffman where an employee using a document, a forged document, a counterfeit document, in order to obtain employment, an employee-employer relationship is not established at that point.
So before we get to Hoffman, where in IRCA does it say that state laws like the WHL and the WPL are precluded?
It does not. What I would say that it does not. What I would say is, though, that generally speaking, work authorization and it's a threshold issue. I don't think it's a supremacy issue necessarily. I think it's a threshold issue. Are you authorized to work under IRCA? But then I agree that when you get down into the more specifics of the wage law,
is it, are you authorized to work or is it a directive to the employer?
I think it's authorized to work. Is the employee authorized to work?
Sorry, I thought I just heard you say that it's not a supremacy clause issue.
I don't think it is.
But we're not talking about preemption.
I don't think we are.
Okay, so you're not arguing that IRCA preempts.
No, I'm arguing that it's a threshold issue that has to be satisfied before you get there. I don't think it's a preemption issue.
So IRCA says at 1324A1A, it's unlawful for a person to hire. Where does it say it's unlawful for, and I don't necessarily recall the precise phrasing that you used, but this is talking to the employer. It's unlawful for a person to hire, and later it's an unlawful person to continue to employ.
I believe that is quoted in the Hoffman case, Your Honor.
You point to the statute and tell us
off the top of my head,
Your Honor, it addresses the issue in front of us. And if not, you can point us to language in Hoffman.
I think the Hoffman court talks about if an employee obtains employment by using a counterfeit or some sort of forged document, that employee is not authorized to work.
Did Hoffman involve facts similar to this case? Did Hoffman involve facts regarding work compensation for work already performed, or was it different factual scenario?
Hoffman does not involve work already performed. The only sort of link Hoffman has to this case is the fact that in Hoffman, the plaintiff did obtain employment by using a forged document or counterfeit document.
And the employee was terminated. The award was for back pay from the date of the employee's termination forward. So
that's correct.
Different from the facts of this case where we're talking very specifically about compensation and back pay for work already performed, not work that had not been performed, but as compensation for some sort of unlawful termination. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Doesn't that distinction matter?
In this case, Mr. Chief Justice, I would say no, because both the trial court and the appellate division did engage in an analysis under the Anderson case. In fact, the trial court says, when they talk about the Anderson case, the trial court, page 21 of its opinion, the number of hours of work, the number of weeks he worked, and were clearly a matter of complete speculation, and this court is left with no reasonable inferences as to the number of weeks he worked long, the number of weeks he worked short, hours.
Did you keep records? Did your client keep records of the hours your employee worked? And you don't dispute that he worked. Correct.
Not dispute that he worked, Your Honor. Did not dispute. In fact, he, in terms of the barter, as we're talking about here, Mr. Juan did not keep hours, did not require hours, did not require him to be on site at any point in time, didn't require him to do anything except take out the garbage a couple times a week, mop the floors a couple times a week.
I'm sorry.
He was free to do whatever else he wanted. And in fact, he testified he was working off-site for various people not related to the buildings for cash, $150, $80, $70.
Sorry, are you disputing then? I thought that it was not disputed in the trial court that Mr. Lopez had testified that he was required to perform general maintenance tasks. Maintenance tasks such as cleaning the common areas, maintaining equipment, shoveling snow, clearing the parking lots, sidewalk cleanup, repairing the washing machines, providing immediate assistance to the tenants if an emergency repair was needed, preparing the buildings for inspections. I thought that there was no dispute for the trial court about that. You just said that all he had to do was take out the garbage twice a week.
Your Honor, aside, the only dispute I think was in terms of the washing machines at trial, but the rest of it, no. He was asked to do certain things.
Mr. Rowan then was allowing him to work, correct?
Yes.
And was not paying him for that work, correct?
Correct.
Even though the WHL and the WPL require that if you allow someone to work, you pay them for that work.
That's what those statutes say, Your Honor. That's correct.
And in response to that, you pointed out to the lack of record keeping. So I want to come back to that.
Yes.
Because my understanding of the law is that both place the burden on the employer. Expressly direct the employer to keep tabs on that and to keep records. Is that incorrect?
That is not incorrect.
So how is it that Mr. Lopez gets faulted in the analysis you were pointing to from the trial court for not having fulsome records when the obligation belongs to the employer?
I would respectfully say, Your Honor, that the trial court did not fault Mr. Lopez. The trial court said that it was a matter of complete speculation. I think that standard is pretty low.
Is that the right starting point? We turn to the individual who did not have the obligation to keep records?
Well, on that basis? I think that, Your Honor, it ultimately, if Mr. Lopez is able to present at trial, I'm going to use this phrase, maybe it's not entirely correct, but it's only going to come to my mind, a prima facie case of hours worked, what he did. If the defendant has no records in their business to dispute that, then that goes undisputed. However,
didn't he say, I worked for 3 years and I was never paid?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
I thought in this case, he does say in the trial court, I worked for 3 years and I was never paid.
He does say that.
And he lists all of his duties that I read out earlier. And you said that there was no dispute on any of them. And they all would clearly take some amount of time, correct?
Correct. And
so given that under the law, it is the duty of the employer and not the employee to keep the records. If he comes to court and he says, I worked for 3 years and I did not get paid. And the employer says, yes, that's correct. And he says, here are all the things that I did. And the employer says, yes, that's correct. How is that not enough to show a prima facie case when it is on the employer to keep the records and not on the employee?
Because I think what you have here is what he did. Okay. I'm agreeing with you. He's an hourly worker. I mean, he's got to show. If he comes in and
he doesn't have to, I'm suggesting that as long as he comes in and says for 3 years I worked and I didn't get paid and here are all the many, many things that I did. And the employer says, yes, that is all true. And he says, and I never got paid. And the employer says, yes, that is all true. Why is it then not up to the employer to show the records that they are required to keep and to say, actually, I didn't permit him and stuff for him? I don't even understand really what the argument is here because the employer seems to be saying that they did permit and suffer him to work.
Your Honor, I agree with you. What I'm saying is, in your scenario, the duties are the duties. He has to give, I think, a finder of fact, a judge here, an amount of hours he's doing it to compute those damages. How do you?
So then I understand that computing damages might be separate, and there was a discussion about whether it should be a remand to compute damages. Right. But he can state a claim by saying, I worked for 3 years. I did all these things. I never got paid.
If that's your question, I think the answer is yes.
And do you agree that Anderson versus Mount Clements should apply the burden shifting approach?
I do agree.
So then isn't it after the employee does that, isn't it incumbent on the employer to come back and proffer some evidence, even if they don't have records?
It is, Your Honor, but I would say that incumbent upon the employee's burden is it has to be credible.
But here, let me ask you a question. Did anything about the duties or responsibilities change between when the W-4 was signed and the 3 years passed? There doesn't seem to be anything in the record to suggest that the duties were lightened as a result of the fact that he couldn't be paid the same amount. Is that accurate?
Can you...
The responsibilities were the same, whether it was with a valid Social Security or without a valid Social Security. It doesn't seem like there was ever a reduction in the responsibility.
I would say the only difference would be that there was no, I think with the, I would say after the W-4 issue, I would say the only difference would be that there were literally no strings attached where Mr. Lopez could leave.
But is
other
that
than that, the responsibilities are the same, yeah.
So for the identical responsibilities at the outset to the point at which he was paid a lesser amount, nothing changed. It. You're saying there was no evidence that was credible that he didn't work the amount of hours that your client was asking him to work.
He wasn't asking him to work any hours. He didn't require any hours. My client did not. The record is clear. He didn't require him to work any hours. There was no hours requirement. There was no hours requirement for him to be there. There was no like time requirement. You have to be here 8 to 5 or whatever the case might be.
Are you reading into that a strict interpretation of the statute that because you didn't assign hours, there was no responsibility to pay for hours?
I'm
not sure of what the relevance of that statement was then, that there weren't hours required.
I'm talking from a purely factual standpoint, not from legal standpoint.
He was required to do work.
Required to do work, but there was no...
And it's conceded that work would take time.
Yes.
Okay.
So what was it that was not credible about Mr. Lopez, based on the record below? What did the trial judge find?
I would say that, Your Honor, there are two areas. I think there is a reference at the trial court level where there is a catch-all phrase where the trial judge says, I don't believe the plaintiff in any way, shape, or form. There is a
more pointed explanation from the trial judge as well.
I'm sorry?
There's a more pointed explanation from the trial judge as well.
Well, he says, I don't believe, he doesn't believe in terms of the W-4. He believes that was signed under penalty of perjury. He views that as a credibility issue. He also believes that in terms of the hours, that they were entirely speculative and that he doesn't believe on his damages side or I'm going to say the liability side, but he doesn't believe anything he says. That was the finding that was made.
Was it appropriate to rely on the false Social Security number as the basis for the credibility determination?
I believe it was. I mean, because it wasn't, because here's my sort of argument on that is everyone's talking about immigration, okay? Trial judge decided this case on credibility. On that issue and on his burden, the plaintiff's burden on the damages side. Said no credibility either way. If the trial judge had ended the opinion there, we might not be here. The trial judge then went into this analysis of Hoffman and said, because the plaintiff used the W-4 in some sort of fraudulent manner to gain employment, under Hoffman, there's no employment relationship. and therefore he falls within Hoffman's sort of box. And he goes on to say, as Hoffman does not preclude work performed, he goes on to say under Anderson, he doesn't have credibility as to the Anderson requirement, and therefore he doesn't recover. I would say this, if I could just, I'll take any more questions you have, but just in sort of a closing. I don't think the appellate division's decision, if it's permitted to stand, has any great, vast presidential value. I think it's very narrow. If I am a worker in New Jersey right now, and I am undocumented, and I'm getting paid in cash, and I'm not getting paid minimum wage or overtime, this case doesn't help the employer at all. Because this case doesn't infringe upon, in the briefing, the Patel line of cases, the Zavala versus Walmart, the Singh case. This case doesn't limit those cases that stand for the principle. If the employee doesn't obtain employment in any sort of fraudulent manner, and performs work and is able to credibly present his case, he wins. This case doesn't help the employers in a vast way in New Jersey. It does not. It only would help an employer if someone comes to work and says, I have status. I'm legal in this country. And the employer employs them and finds out after the fact that that was not the case. So I don't think this has a great chilling. I would respectfully submit that this case does not have a great chilling effect on claims for documented or undocumented folks and workers in the state.
No person who's undocumented could obtain a position for work because they have no documents to prove they're eligible to work, right?
Tax ID.
Tax ID number is not work authorization.
I agree with you, but Your Honor, here's the thing. If this case doesn't, this case says that there's no employer-employee relationship because Mr. Lopez lied on the W-4. If I go to work for you and I am undocumented and you say to me, do you have a social security number? And I say no. And you say, okay, I'm going to pay you in cash. And you don't pay me minimum wage, this case doesn't help you. I don't think this case helps you if I sue you. Because then you're in the Patel line of cases. The Patel line of cases is folks are paid in cash. They're working for employers. They're not getting minimum wage or appropriate overtime, what have you. They ask for it. The employer says no, because you're undocumented. The court says no. They're undocumented, okay. Their employees, okay, work is performed, they win. This case does not, for workers in New Jersey who are undocumented, who are working and getting paid and not getting paid what they're supposed to be getting paid, I do not think the appellate division case, if it stands, helps the employer at all.
That seems to say that it's okay for an employer for an employer to pay someone who's undocumented less cash than they should be paying them, but it is okay for the employer to not pay the undocumented person at all. How does that make any sense?
I thought you were just saying,
if you're getting cash, but you're not getting enough cash, you can still bring a claim. You just can't bring a claim here where you're not getting any cash.
No, if you're talking about whether you think that this case can be used to weaponize the barter scenario, is that what you're asking me?
Well, because the law doesn't actually provide for the barter scenario is not an exception to any of the laws, correct?
I agree with that. But I think if a person who's undocumented is being subject to a barter and not getting paid at all, I don't think this case helps the employer either. As long as I don't, because if you're bartering with me and not paying me and saying I'm giving you a car or what have you, and I'm doing all kinds of work for you and I sue, bring an action, I don't think this case helps you.
And that's because of the credibility determination.
I agree. Yes.
So the principle you would want the court to issue is that in the scenario where an individual lies on their job application or as part of negotiating the position, that they could work and not be paid by the employer as a result under the WPH and the WHL.
Indefinitely.
WPL, yeah.
I wouldn't say that. I would say, if you're asked, if I could be so bold as to give you guidance, I would say that the guidance would be something along the lines of if an undocumented worker lies in order to obtain employment, their ability to sue under wage and hour or wage payment law might be compromised.
What if he lied about his address? What if he didn't want the employer to know that he came from an area associated with very violent gang activity? So he lies about his address.
On the W-4?
Are you saying that the same principle would apply? That because he lied about a fact on the application,
no,
that the employer would be absolved? So if your answer is no, then are you saying that it's only because the lie had to do here with his immigration status and nothing else, no, that it changes the scenario?
No, I'm saying that in a W-4, in your scenario, the address isn't what's getting him allowing.
Well, that's not what you just said. You just said if he lies on the form.
Okay.
Then
I agree. If he lie, I would say if he lies, if a person lies, the address isn't needed to in order to pay an employee for tax purposes. The social is.
Well, the social certainly wasn't needed here in order to pay this employee for having done work for him.
It wasn't, but it was not. But if Mr. Lopez hadn't given the false social and Mr. Juan's not paying him, I think Lopez wins the case. But he placed that out there. He gave him a social he knew wasn't valid, and he gave it to him and he signed that form. I think that the guidance, I think, has to be fashioned around that.
So your credibility question then seems to only to go to issues of immigration.
No, because I would respectfully say no, because the W-4 form, as the Supreme Court said in the Garcia case, does not do immigration law. What the court says, that case says that the W-4 form has nothing to do with immigration law, nothing.
So you're saying that the employee could potentially lie about other things on the application, it wouldn't matter, but because he lied about this, it matters.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. It's not a perfect solution, but I do think that something material to employment as a social might be a guidance.
So if someone lies and doesn't provide their social, provides a fake social, and never provides a social, and they actually are a U.S. citizen, and engages in the same barter agreement, the arrangement here, and sues for back pay, they're out. They don't get back pay under the wage payment law or the wage hour law either.
If a citizen gave
a fake social security number, the employer comes back and says, this isn't a real social security number. Maybe the employee doesn't want to give a real social security number because they maybe have a criminal background or doesn't want something to come up, but they're a U.S. citizen. But same exact scenario here. And then they file for compensation.
I believe they then
don't have a claim.
I would say yes, that's correct.
And we're okay, so the guidance that you articulated, where is what statute? What is that based in?
I don't.
If someone lies, they can't. They cannot sustain a claim for back pay. I just want to understand, because I think we've already covered that. That's found nowhere in the WHL, nowhere in the WPL. I know you mentioned Hoffman earlier. We discussed the very clear factual distinctions between Hoffman and this case. So, what if this court were to agree with your guidance? What are we basing that on? Are we just making that up?
No.
Because we have a lot of statutes in front of us. I understand that.
I think it's based on Hoffman. I do.
But Hoffman, I'm sorry, is based on IRCA, And in Justice Pierre-Louis' hypothetical, you said it applies even to a citizen. Well, and you said that you're not arguing that IRCA PM preempts the wage payment law or the wage and hour law.
I'm not arguing that IRCA preempts the wage payment law. I'm arguing it's still IRCA, it's a threshold issue.
It's only a threshold issue because of Hoffman only deals with IRCA in that it is talking about people who are undocumented.
That is true. Okay. Yes. That's true.
The regulations that accompany IRCA specifically define employee as an individual who provides services or labor for an employer for wages or other remuneration. Wouldn't you agree that Lopez falls under that definition? If not, what aspect of that definition does Lopez fail? An individual who provides services or labor for an employer for wages or other remuneration.
He falls under that definition.
He does.
How do you respond to the plaintiff's request that if we remand, it should be remanded only for damages?
I think that if it's remanded, I think that it has to be for a new trial.
Why?
I think there could be, well, I would say this, it depends on the court's decision ultimately. If the court is going to say that the issue of the Social Security number and the W-4 in the narrative and that testimony and that test of credibility is off the table completely and out, then I think you're talking about a trial dealing with the Anderson issue and the burden shifting and plaintiff's proofs on what he worked, how many hours he worked, what he did, and the credit coming back on the barter side of what was provided. I think in that scenario, yes. But I think, if the court is inclined to give guidance to the trial court on how to deal with the Social Security number credibility issue, I think it's for a new trial with those instructions.
Sorry, but if the court were to hold that the Social Security number, even if it could come in as part of the narrative, could not be used to impeach Mr. Lopez's credibility because of the interplay between Rule 607 and 608, then you'd be in the same position of what you just
said. Yes, I think that's right. Okay. You articulated it better than I did.
But I want to come back to your understanding of the statutory framework. Could a company, a real estate management company, put out an ad that says, we will hire individuals who don't have a Social Security number, and we will pay them in the form of a barter arrangement? Anything wrong with that?
I don't think a real estate management company could do that.
No. Keep your voice up, please.
I don't think an employer could make that advertisement.
Because I thought earlier, and why not?
Because at the end of the day,
forget about bad PR. Why couldn't they do it?
No, it's not that, Your Honor. I think at the end of the day, wage and hour law, I think Justice also indicated that the intent of the statute is payment.
Sorry, but under the wage and hour law, actually, that would be fine. As long as the person was being paid in kind, the value of what they worked. Oh. Here the issue is he was working more than $800 a month, and the only thing that he was, or if you say that the apartment was actually worth $800 a month, because under the wage and payment law, I don't know how you would then decide if it's being paid once every 2 weeks, but I think your adversary pointed out that under the wage and hour law and the wage payment law, you can be paid in food and lodging. It just has to be the amount of the minimum wage and a fair wage.
There would be, I think you're right. So there would be a value if the case goes back. If we're just talking about the damages thing, I think I'm in line where the case goes back, the court, or there has to be a value placed on what he was provided to to offset what?
So take that off the table.
Okay.
I'm suggesting in my question that this free rent doesn't cover the value of the services.
Okay.
Can you put on an ad that says, we'll hire people without social security numbers and then pay them at a reduced rate that doesn't match up to what the WHL and the WPL require?
I don't think you can do.
So IRCA is not a problem from what you've told us earlier. Is that fair?
I agree.
And it's only I'm fine. Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Weiss.
Thank you, Chief Justice, members of the court. In rebuttal, I just want to touch briefly on two issues. First, I actually wanted to go back to the Chief Justice's question about whether a judge or a jury is appropriate in these types of cases. I wanted to address that. I might have responded incorrectly in my initial statement, and or I might have been confused on the question, and it seemed more clear to me when it was asked to a subsequent counsel. Under the New Jersey wage and hour law and wage payment law, petitioner's position would be that there certainly is a right to a jury trial. I believe that that right comes directly from New Jersey's constitution, quite frankly. I don't have a specific citation for you, but just as there's a right to a jury trial and other civil causes of action, there is one here. The only reason a bench trial took place was because there was an agreement between the parties in this case.
Can you tell us in your experience whether these cases are ordinarily handled through a bench trial?
In my personal experience, it really varies. I have tried these cases before a jury in federal court on multiple occasions. They are oftentimes done by bench trial as well, to the extent that the calculation of damages can be a little bit cumbersome for a jury, and they derive from a statutory means to some extent. If you're paid below the minimum wage, it has to be the minimum wage. Calculating hours, and there's the burden shifting framework. So sometimes there is, in the interest of efficiency, a reason to do it before a court, but juries are very capable of doing them as well. And sometimes there are factual issues that are complex that it makes sense to have a jury to resolve in some sense, or not that it makes sense for them to resolve, but that a plaintiff might want a jury of their peers to resolve, that they have that right. And I think that is important.
May I ask you a question about the record in this case?
Yes.
The judge's pivotal finding was, as to credibility, signed the W-4, lied, knew at the time that he wrote the Social Security number that it wasn't valid. In the record, is there a discussion about immigration status?
In the record, it's generally a discussion of his status by proxy through discussion of his lack of a Social Security number. To be perfectly candid with the court, it's a little bit of a complicated situation. There was a hearing in the judges, or there was a meeting in the judges' chambers before this trial took place. The judge explained to the parties that there was no question that immigration status wasn't relevant to this trial. And plaintiff was asked if, there's not going to be testimony about his immigration status, would there be testimony about that? On the W-4, he technically did put his taxpayer ID number. It wasn't a false Social Security number. And there was an agreement that there would be no need to talk about that, since all of the evidence concerning his immigration status was not going to be allowed in. What subsequently happened was evidence concerning his immigration status was not allowed in, and neither was the fact that he put his taxpayer ID in the boxes for the Social Security number. But honestly, it's irrelevant. It's immaterial. Whether he put a false Social Security number or a taxpayer ID number or anything else, it doesn't change the fact that he worked for defendants, and that that defendant should have been held liable for damages under the New Jersey wage and hour law and wage payment law. I think you know, you have all heard what respondents' counsel purported defendants to say. Fix this and I will pay you. Mr. Lopez had the power to stop this. You know, this really just comes down to whether or not Mr. Lopez is going to be afforded equal protection under the law, under New Jersey's wage and hour laws, as an employee, despite being undocumented, because that is what has stood between him and a rightful verdict in this case for years now. And I believe, you know, I don't want to assume how the court is taking in the evidence in this matter, but I think that even through respondents' counsel's argument, it's the elements that prove this case have all been there since the trial level. And yet, due to these misapplications of the law that generally stem from his status, his immigration status, he's been denied relief for years at this point, which is why we're asking that this be remanded solely for the purpose of damages, because the record is complete, and that's he should have been awarded damages in the first place. Further and last, I would like to take the court back to the potential guidance it might offer on immigration status and proxies for status as well. And going back to, even if this is an examination under Rule 403, we've heard argument today about when did defendant figure out that Mr. Lopez might not be documented. Was it when he obtained the W-4? Was it when the payroll said they couldn't pay him pursuant to the W-4? Even though, as respondents' counsel pointed out, W-4 is not used to show authorization for work, when exactly was it? It doesn't matter is the answer. It's completely irrelevant and immaterial. It does not make any fact more or less likely. And even to the extent it's part of the narrative, it bogs down the narrative with an immaterial fact. You know, we're wondering about, we're talking about whether, you know, a social security number could be on an employment application or a W-4, that information could be redacted. This court could offer guidance to the lower courts saying that the prejudice is extremely high concerning this information. There is a chilling effect. There is, and more importantly, possibly, is just that there is no probative value. When you're looking at in the context of the balancing test, more importantly, there is no probative value. When you're looking at the underlying policies and remedial nature of New Jersey's wage and hour laws, the more important part is the chilling effect that this type of evidence has, and the prejudice that it causes on individuals like Mr. Lopez.
Thank you.
Go ahead
if you had something else. I thought you were done.
No, Your Honor. I was just saying, unless the court has any questions.
Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in recess for the day.